Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet, but I am not in Edinburgh as we usually are. Frank, where am I?
You are in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in the hub of the universe, David.
Okay, fine. And why are we, Frank, why are we in Cambridge, Massachusetts, as opposed to our usual venue of my office in Edinburgh?
We are attending the Scheer meeting, and Scheer is the Society for Historians of the Early American Republic. This is the one history conference that every person should go to. It is the one that cannot be missed.
That's pretty high praise. I thought SASO would be the conference everyone should go to, but here is somewhat bigger.
Yeah.
And this is my first year. And Frank, how many years have you been to?
Oh, I don't know. I've been coming to Scheer for probably 20 years. In fairness, I can't say that I have an unbroken streak. I mean, because it is difficult to get to, and it's in the middle of the from the UK. And in fact, I had a 40-plus-hour journey here, but that's another story. So I haven't made everyone in the past 20 years, but I've been coming pretty consistently for 20 years.
All right. So one of the things about conferences like this is we get to meet and interact with historians from all over the world, the best of the best, and we have, you know. Well, Frank, you want to do the introductions?
Absolutely. We're thrilled today to have a friend and colleague, Shira Lurie from, I've known Shira for a couple of years at least, and Shira has just completed her PhD at the University of Virginia and now has a position at the University of Toronto, and we're going to let her speak for herself, though, because actually nothing would be more conferencing-y than sort of two white guys talking over a woman. I don't think we should do that, David. So let's welcome Shira and let her introduce herself, I suppose. So Shira, tell us about yourself.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. Tell you about myself. So as you said, I just finished my PhD at UVA, and I am now about to begin as a short-term assistant professor at the University of Toronto, cross-listed between history and Canadian studies.
Okay,
so my official title is very long, the University College Fellow in Early American History.
Okay, and early American there is, the American and early American is capacious because it's not U.S. necessarily, it's not
That's
restricted
right.
to the U.S.
That's right.
So can you tell us what your PhD was on?
My PhD was on these things called Liberty Poles. So I'm very interested in protest in the early United States. And in the 1790s, the major form of protest was to raise a liberty pole. So they were tall wooden masts decorated with political messages on signs and flags. And they're first raised by patriots in the American Revolution. But then in the 1790s, the Republicans, the Jeffersonians, they raised liberty poles to protest the Washington and Adams administrations to say, you are acting like monarchists, you're acting like tyrants. So we're using this revolutionary symbol to protest and resist your legislation. And the Federalists, those who supported the Washington and Adams administrations, would tear down the Liberty Poles. So there was a lot of local conflict over these Liberty Poles, and I'm very interested in this conversation about where protest fits in American democracy, if American citizens are able to engage in politics in these kind of extra-legal, extra-institutional ways, or if now under a representative democracy they should just vote in elections and not engage in politics in between.
Interesting. So there's obviously some contemporary resonance there. We'll get mm-hmm. to that in a second. But mm-hmm. but before we move on from that, I want to ask you about liberty poles.
Sure.
So how many of these things were erected around the country, both during the Revolution and during the 1790s? Have you been able mm-hmm. to kind of map them?
So these are obviously just reported cases. I imagine that there were a lot more. During the Revolution, the number is around 59. In the 1790s, 1794 to 1800, we're looking at about 120. And then,
so twice as many.
Yeah, yeah. And then in the 19th century, it really explodes. But there's a big difference because Whigs and Democrats both raise liberty poles just as campaign symbols. So they are no longer have these kind of resistance connotations. They're no longer protest symbols. They're really just about rallying support for the party ticket. So then there's hundreds in the 19th century.
Right, okay. So is this a case where a symbol that was initially quite radical mm-hmm. is appropriated and kind of loses its potency as a result of that? Would you go that far?
It's interesting because there are certain instances still in the 19th century where the radical connotations return. So during the nullification crisis, liberty poles are raised. During the Civil War, liberty poles are raised. So it's in those kind of moments when democracy seems in peril, or at least this sort of political system seems in peril, that liberty poles return to their kind of radical origins. But it certainly seems as though political parties become the method through which people are seeking political change. So in the second party system, it becomes more about electing your representative who will hopefully change the law once they're in Congress or the presidency, versus we are, as the people, need to rally for political change by resisting legislation. So I think the change in the liberty polls becomes about institutional politics kind of becoming a, more so a channel for dissent, whereas in the early republic, people were less confident in political parties' ability to do that.
Now, I'm a fairly concrete. These things look like flagpoles, though, basically, right? Or
but sometimes
poles?
Taller. Yeah. So think of a ship's mast is sort of how, where they originated. And they varied in height, but yeah, essentially flagpoles, they would sometimes have flags, sometimes have weather vanes, sometimes have kind of boards affixed to them, sometimes have liberty caps on them.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so how tall are these things? Are they?
There's a big range.
Okay.
There's a big range. So some are on like 15 feet, 20 feet. Some are reported at being as being over 100 feet tall, it's, which
wow.
seems impossible. Yeah.
And
sorry.
Well, and so when, what's the, or what's the backstory
mm-hmm.
for when where this idea came from that
mm-hmm.
the way you celebrate liberty or protest is to take a tree, cut off all of its branches, and stick it up in the middle of the town?
So the first one is raised in New York City in celebration of the Stamp Act's repeal. And so it's actually not really a protest symbol. It's decorated with decorations that proclaim the king, but it's made of white pine, and white pine was a very politicized material in New York City because the British Navy had monopolized white pine for use in its shipbuilding. So to the colonists, it was kind of a symbol of the empire infringing on colonial rights. So the fact that it's a ship's mast made of white pine that they raise is fairly telling. So that's sort of the origin story in North America, although you can go back to maypoles, which had political connotations in Europe, also as a as an inspiration. And then there's also the Vindicta in ancient Rome, which is kind of like a wooden wand where you would tap a slave to give them their freedom and hand them a liberty cap. So in iconography, you'll see like the goddess of liberty or Britannia is holding a wooden wand with a liberty cap on top. So it would have been legible as a symbol of liberty.
So when the thing went up in New York City in the 1760s, people sort of immediately knew what that meant.
I think so.
People didn't say, why are you electing a mast in the middle of the city? That doesn't make it.
No, yeah.
Okay, that's interesting.
And it's right after the Liberty Tree becomes as well in Boston. Yeah.
Right, so the Liberty Tree and the Liberty
mm-hmm.
Pole are sort of related.
Yeah, I think so.
Items of iconography?
Or
really,
I mean, of
icons?
Course, there's important differences, right? The Liberty Tree grows naturally from the ground. Liberty Pole is erected by humans and moved as desired, decorated as desired.
It's a portable Liberty Tree.
Yeah.
How long do they keep them up?
Well, that also depends. And so during the Revolution, Redcoats and Loyalists would tear them down.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, people would replace Liberty Poles because they're getting kind of old and worn. So it really depended on the situation.
But the intention, at least initially, would be to leave it up as a kind of semi-permanent.
Yeah, leave it up, and then it would be a place to meet, right?
Right.
So you'd
meet
at the Liberty Pole, especially when we get into the early Republic. 4th of July celebrations are often held at the Liberty Pole.
Right. Okay.
So it's a place.
When
to
is
meet.
The last one put up that you know about?
Well, it depends how we define. So actually in 2015,
okay.
Marijuana legalization in D.C. statehood activists raised a Liberty Pole in the National Mall, and they chained themselves to it. So that's, I guess, the most recent protest one. I believe a community in Bedford raises a Liberty Pole every 4th of July as a kind of celebration.
In Bedford, Massachusetts.
In Bedford, Massachusetts,
right.
And then loyalists, quote-unquote, try to tear it down, and it's like a whole kerfuffle.
Now, one of the things we've seen, and you'll know this because you're interested in, you know, political iconography, I guess, is the appropriation of the Revolutionary era symbols by, particularly by white nationalists in the U.S. So the Gadsden flag, the Don't Tread on Me flag, for example, is a good case. Are we seeing the appropriation of Liberty Poles by the, you know, well, white nationalists in the U.S. now?
I have not yet. Not that I have come across. I would more so hope that, you know, those who wish to resist certain policies coming out of the Trump administration would take up the Liberty poll.
Right.
So that is where I would hope that we would see it again. But I'm not sure if the Liberty poll is so well known in current culture that it would be a powerful enough symbol for right now nationalists, but I don't know.
Interesting. Because they you know, we're both historians of the revolutionary era, but it's been interesting to me to see how they've appropriated the revolution in a particular way, and a particular version of the revolution, of course, as well, white nationalist movement.
Mm-hmm.
But
interesting.
So thanks for that, Shira. I mean, the discussion of the contemporary use of these symbols naturally takes us to politics. And one of the conceits of this podcast is that we're seeking to provide some historical context for contemporary events. And I know you've participated in the kind of public discourse of this current moment, both in your native Canada and here in the United States. And I'd be interested if you could tell us a little bit about this. So you wrote a piece for the Washington Post, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the piece itself, but also what your experiences have been in its aftermath and what you've learned from it, I guess.
Right. So after the 2016 election, two historians, Nicole Hemmer and Brian Rosenwald, they created this opinion section called Made by History, where historians write op-eds that contextualize current news events, put them in their historical context. So I was seeing this news break that Trump was planning the Salute to America event on the 4th of July, where he was going to deliver a speech. And I saw a lot of criticism in the press that from Democrats who were saying, Trump is politicizing the 4th of July. How dare he make this a political event? How dare he make it a partisan event? And anyone who's read almost anything on early America knows that the 4th of July has been a political event for as long as it's been an event. So I decided to write this piece, and what it basically says, it gives that sort of brief history and talks about the various ways in which political parties and political groups have used the 4th of July to kind of claim the revolution, as we spoke about. And it goes on to make the case that even current celebrations that we think of as apolitical, like a parade or the songs that are sung on the 4th of July, or the references to the American military that are made, I argue that those are all very intensely political and they have consequences as well. So people who are criticizing Trump for quote-unquote politicizing the 4th need to think more critically about the ways in which the 4th of July is celebrated and how perhaps this kind of event that was meant to be about commemorating revolution and the promises of self-government has instead become about reifying the state and allegiance to those who wield political and military power, and about American quote-unquote greatness and its monopoly on freedom, and how all of those things are problematic and may have led us to Trump in the first place. So that was the piece, and I expected to get some pushback, but what was interesting was I got pushback from both sides. So as I expected, some people were upset with me for problematizing American patriotism and claiming that there was real problems with glorifying the military and so on. And that's what I expected. What I didn't expect was to get some pushback from other people who were saying I was a Trump apologist and that I was saying, you know, it was fine for him to be having this rally and everyone was overreacting. So that was an interesting surprise.
What form did the pushback take?
I got some emails, and I got a lot of feedback on Twitter about it. And my favorite email said, you know, went on and on about, you know, why are you saying America isn't the greatest nation on earth, so-and-so, and if America's so bad, why don't you just go live in Canada? So they didn't Google me too carefully, I don't think, but
would you do it again? Was it a difficult process? I mean, it's... Were you trolled, I guess I should put.
I think in comparison to what other people have experienced, I think it was fine. I didn't get any death threats, thankfully.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, I wasn't, you know, targeted that I can recall for being a woman. I think, you know, if you're angering a certain brand of person, you're probably doing something right, and I certainly stand by everything I wrote in the piece, so yeah, of course I would do it again.
Because they've had a couple of panels here at Shear yesterday on public engagement, and Nicole Hemmer was on one of them, and you know, one of the through lines through both those panels was that we're at this really interesting moment where historians can interact with the general public in a way we've never been able to before, including early career people who are either still in graduate school or just soon after leaving graduate school, in a, you know, through podcasts and in op-eds and all kinds of ways. But that there's like this cost-benefit analysis you have to do about how it works. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, I think Nicole made this point, is you only often see the bad feedback you get, you know, that, you know, 10,000 people may have read the op-ed, and five people may have been really angry.
Yeah.
But you remember the five people because they're the ones who write you the nasty notes.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, that is the good thing about Twitter as well, is a lot of friends, especially who are historians, really plugged the piece and thanked me for the piece and praised it, which I appreciated. So you kind of try to hold on to to those comments as opposed to all the less informed, more hateful ones.
As a young scholar, newly minted PhD at the beginning of her career, do you think this is an important aspect of your career development? Yeah, I mean, do you need to kind of build a brand? I don't like that language, but
that's the language people are using.
Do you need to build a brand as part of your career development and positioning yourself and seeking to, you know, because the careers that David and I have had, you know, your career is going to look different. I think will look very different from what we've done just because the profession is changing. This is something, you know, if you talk to colleagues, young and old, experienced and inexperienced or less experienced in the conference, this is a kind of theme that comes up over coffee all the time or drinks, right?
Yeah.
So the profession is changing, and it's changing in unexpected ways. And I guess I'm asking you, as somebody who's at the beginning of her career, beginning of what I hope will be a very successful career. You know, how important is this kind of brand building? Because it wasn't something I had to worry about when I was in your position.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, you're told very on in graduate school, build your CV, constantly be looking at your CV, see areas that you can improve upon. So there is always an element to that, and publications are great no matter what. But for me, I've really spent some time thinking about the type of historian I want to be, and you know, the truth about something like this Washington Post piece is that probably more people are going to read that than read my first book, you know?
Mm. Or the not members probably.
Of, yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, Liberty Falls, though. Liberty Falls. So, you know, there's something to be said for this kind of work, just as a historian and intellectual, and I felt like this particular area, because I've done work in it, I had a contribution to make. So it was sort of less about, you know, I didn't know that it was going to blow up and that I would get some interview requests and stuff from it. What I knew was I had something to say about it, and I felt like what I had to say, I wanted people to hear.
Yeah.
And this was the avenue to do that, as opposed to some other form.
Right. But if, I mean, I can see that, but as you're putting, say, a job application together.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't,
you
know, hurt.
Yeah, do you have a paragraph in your letter
yeah.
about this and this kind of activity on your part?
Oh, maybe I should. This is a good suggestion. I have a paragraph that's about, that's like a CV summary. So it says, you know, I have this journal article, I'm working on this, I've written pieces for the Washington Post, I've appeared on the Whiskey and Bone podcast. That's like its own little section. So I guess in that way I'm trying to show, you know, I'm engaged beyond just writing this book, that I'm doing all these other sorts of things, and hopefully from my CV they can see that I, you know, come to things like Shear and all that, that I'm an engaged scholar in a lot of different avenues.
Yeah, because I mean, you used to have like basically like two paragraph big sections in those mm-hmm. letters you wrote, and one would be, here's how I teach, and here's the research I do. Mm-hmm. But I think now there's this third dimension that, that people have to have about, you know, how am I engaging with the public, and people sort of want to see. So it's like an extra third of things
right.
that you know, going through graduate school is hard enough as it is. and I, you know, people are feeling now that they have to have a podcast and 10,000 Twitter followers, you know, and all these other kinds of things. And that's a lot. I mean, that's a lot to do on top of
right.
writing the damn dissertation.
Which right. is, and it's complicated because you do need that, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. But we're not. You're not going to get a job based on
yeah.
Twitter. You know, you're
yeah.
better off writing your book in that
tenure,
sense. Or get tenure.
Yeah,
your tweets
yeah.
aren't tenurable.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's exactly. I mean, I think, you know, for me, at least, just as a historian, it's important to be public-facing.
Mm.
But I would say you need to do it in the way that makes sense for you. I like to write, so seeking out opportunities to write op-eds and things like that makes sense
yeah.
for me, whereas, you know, a podcast or a website or something would make sense
for somebody else.
So I don't think you have to do it all. I think you need to find the place that makes the most sense for your history and skill set and interest.
Yeah.
So given your interest in forms of political expression, I guess, popular forms of political
mm-hmm.
expression, is that a fair
Perfect.
Characterization? And the piece you wrote for the post on the 4th of July, what did you think of the recent 4th of July celebration? And I want to ask you also, because you appeared on Canadian TV to comment
yeah.
on Trump's speech, so we'll get to that
yeah.
in a second, but just as an expert on this kind of behavior,
yeah.
what was your response?
You know, it was fascinating because there was a lot of concern, and I had a lot of concern whenever Trump speaks, you know, what's he going to say and what dangers will arise from it. And what was fascinating to me was, for the most part, that was a speech anyone could have given, right? That was not a Trump brand speech. And I thought that it really validated what I had to say, right? We had this almost hour-long glorification of the military and this sort of cheering about victories in war that I found very distasteful, and a lot of chants of USA, USA, and all those types of things were really, you know, what I had been saying, that the ways in which America is celebrated on the 4th of July are deeply troubling.
Mm.
So that was...
The bit about the airports was very typically
Trump. Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
airports.
Yeah.
Everyone
yeah.
says that on the 4th of July. Right? That's the traditional traditional toast that's
what
Lincoln
did.
and then you went on Canadian television to talk about the speech? Is that correct?
That's right.
And how was that?
So that was fun. It was a whirlwind. As I said, I didn't expect anything to come from this piece, and then I started getting these interview requests. I was actually on BBC Radio. They have a program called Up All Night. So if you were awake at 3:15 in the UK, you may have heard me talking about it. And then the following day, I did a short piece for CBC. And then CTV News, I was in studio to kind of analyze the speech in real time, which was exciting and nerve-wracking and difficult. But, it was quite a thing.
And did you get any... have you had any feedback from the public based on those appearances in your comments?
I did get a few tweets from dissatisfied viewers who were upset that I was saying glorifying war was a bad idea. They felt that was...
Now, were these Canadians or non-Canadians?
No, these were Canadians. And I think
okay.
and one of them, I think, even tweeted... Let me try and remember what they said. Something about, like, apologizing to Americans... for the things that I had said to insult the nation. So it was good they did that for me. That was...
Well,
yeah.
being polite. It's
yeah,
top
yeah,
brand.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, nothing more Canadian than apologizing.
Yeah, but yeah, you know, you just gotta... I block the stuff that is hateful. I don't read the comments on the article, and that's just... that's just common sense and self-preservation. Yeah, that's stuff I don't need.
So, as a Canadian, how did you get first interested in history south of the border?
That's a question I get all the time, and I don't have a satisfactory answer, really. Except to say, you know, in Canada we do learn American history in school, so I've taken it in high school and then in university. And I've always kind of been interested in politics and political theory, and so I started studying the Revolution as an undergrad, as I thought, you know, this is a particular moment in time. And then as I was studying that, I discovered actually I was more interested in the early republic and these ideas about what it means to be a citizen was really where my interest lay. So it kind of just happened organically.
Do you think you're bringing a different perspective? Do you think being Canadian informed your approach to the topic?
I think where it informs it is that there are certain maybe national myths or national narratives that I haven't been inculcated with. I didn't grow up with stories of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. And so I learned all these stories as history, right, in school. And I was already, 16, 17 years old. So it wasn't really a formative part of my culture or identity. And so I think maybe that has been a little freeing in terms of my ability to critique certain things that I see. And certainly when I've noticed a difference when I teach American history in the United States versus Canada, that in when you teach in the United States, especially the Revolutionary period, there's a lot of unlearning that has to happen, or a lot of freeing of the students. So when they finally realize, yes, they can think about the Revolution as neutral. Was it actually a good thing for all people everywhere, right? That's a moment that you see on students' faces when they realize it's not an inherently positive thing. And that doesn't happen in Canada.
And do you have the same experience, Frank, when you're teaching the Revolution in Scotland?
Yeah, it's very similar, in fact. I mean, and I like your phrase about unlearning. Yeah. So with some of our students who are, as you know, David, a lot of our students are from the U.S., but not a majority. So it's very interesting to have a classroom where a significant number of the students are actually from the U.S. when you're teaching the Revolution, but also with the majority that are not, because they really do see it from a different perspective. Again, in our context, of course, we also get people, not all of our students are necessarily Scottish nationalists, but I've had Scottish nationalists in my classroom who identify with the rebels and declaring independence because they think, but they're doing it to serve their own contemporary political agenda, if you will. That sounds more cynical. In the way they're interpreting the events.
Sure.
So you do get it. Shira, I think it's interesting and fun.
Yeah, the one thing I miss pedagogically about teaching in the UK is the one that the tools you have when you're in the US is the unlearning. I know you all grew up thinking this, but I'm going to complicate it in this particular way, you don't get to do that in the same degree when you're teaching outside of the US.
Well, not with the Civil War, but with the Revolution, it's fun because you can say. Oh, the British are the bad guys, of course. and you're trying to get the Americans to unlearn that. But of course, with the British students, it's good to be provocative and to say, you guys really, you stand for tyranny. complicate that, of course.
It's a good starting point.
It's a good starting point, because, of course, it's not true. I think that's where my field is a little bit. I've got an easier entree into. In the classroom than you probably do, because the Civil War is a Civil War.
Well, yeah, but for when teaching about the Civil War, when the British students for the most part think, right, this starts because of slavery.
Right.
Whereas in the States, you actually have to make that argument because there's all this sort of nonsense about states' rights or the tariff or some other kind of thing. They say, oh, this is about slavery, and there's not that, and they don't, the ways in which they approach some of those things, they're less willing to say, try to defend Robert E. Lee or whoever. In some ways, the varnish is already worn off because it never existed in the first place.
So, you did your undergraduate degree in Canada.
That's right. So I did my BA and MA at the University of Western Ontario.
Nice. Okay. And then you went to UVA for your PhD. Mm-hmm. Why did you make that choice? And was it, what was there a, we tend to think with some justification that, Canada and the United States are integrated culturally in lots of ways. But of course, as you know better than we do, that only goes so far. Mm-hmm. There are profound differences. And the longer you're in one of the other places, you realize what the differences are. So what was the acculturation into a new, both a new institution, but also a new culture like for you in Charlottesville?
Yeah, I was pretty naive because I did buy into that. Well, I'm not moving.
Basically the same.
Across. Yeah, this is, we, you know, our cultures are similar enough and it'll be fine. And I mean, I love my time in Charlottesville, but it was a lot more difficult than I imagined it would be. Navigating, you know, the healthcare system and, you know, navigating gun culture in Virginia and kind of what I felt to be somewhat aggressive Christianity in Virginia. Those were all things I hadn't experienced growing up in the suburb of Toronto. And again, of course, there were things that I loved about living in Virginia and my time in Charlottesville and at UVA. But I was naive. I didn't think I would see Confederate flags on cars. And I saw one maybe once a day when I was in Charlottesville. So those were things that I hadn't thought deeply enough before I went that were a bit surprising to encounter.
And were you in Charlottesville when the riots happened back in 2017?
I actually was at home in Toronto on my summer visit home, but I watched from afar.
But knowing Charlottesville as you did at that point, as you were, okay, you were home, but you were, your home was Charlottesville at that point as well.
Yes,
what was that like for you both, and what was the aftermath like
when you got back? I mean, it was so emotional. I was actually at the vigil for Heather Heyer when her parents visited for the first time. So
Heather Heyer was the woman who was killed.
So it was incredibly emotional, and it still is. And, you know, it was interesting to see how UVA tried to grapple with what had happened. So there was, you know, official responses in terms of there was this group that was developed to think about, you know, monuments on campus, to think about the way permits are granted on campus. Nicole Hemmer has, can I plug another podcast?
Sure, of course you can.
Nicole Hemmer has a great podcast called A12 that situates what happened in Charlottesville that summer with the history of Charlottesville, which was fascinating. So it was interesting.
That's a wonderful
to see.
Podcast.
Yeah, it's a terrific podcast. And so, yeah, it was interesting to see, you know, how the city and how the university tried to deal with it, but it was, you know, very troubling. I remember going to an event that was held, kind of a teach-in, that was held at the start of the year, and there were students, first-year students of color were saying, you know, I don't feel safe on campus, and I don't know how I can ever be expected to feel safe on campus. So, yeah, it was difficult, and for someone who studies, you know, monuments and public space, it was really eye-opening to have all those things I've been thinking about brought home in a real way.
Did you think the university responded appropriately, or, I mean, it was a very difficult circumstance?
I mean, I think, especially with the evidence brought to light on A12, I think there's a lot of questions about the university, what they knew ahead of time, and the police, and all those sorts of things. I think, you know, there's a lot more that can be done to think about whether we need to have certain monuments in the city, and specifically on campus. Mm-hmm. So I think there's always more that can be done, and there's great work already being done on UVA campus, especially by student groups like the Living Wage Group and all that kind of thing that are fighting for racial and economic justice on campus. So groups like that give me hope, but I think there's always room for improvement.
I think it's remarkable. You've seen this in a lot of campuses where there's an intersection between this discourse about monuments in the past and questions about social justice today the rights of university employees, whether those are, you know, people who are, you know, janitors and other service people on campus, and the ways in which all these things fit together. You know, I think it's opened up the eyes of a lot of students who are unaware of the ways in which this deep history is connected with, you know, deep injustices in the present.
Yeah, that's right.
You of course went to the University of Virginia. You're a historian of the early Revolution and early Republic. The Jeffersonian and the Jeffersonian presence is rather profound.
That's putting it mildly.
Well, the other way, I often think of it feels like a kind of Thomas Jefferson theme park.
Sometimes. Yeah,
yeah. That's right.
I'm not asking you to endorse or repudiate that statement, but
I'd love there to be like a roller coaster ride, Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah.
But how do you feel about that? I mean, as a historian of the period, but he's, first of all, he's a figure who's not without controversy.
Exactly.
But also, how do you feel? I'm always interested to talk to my friends and colleagues at UVA mm-hmm. about this. What's your view of that?
Yeah, I am. I'm not a part of the TJ fan club. So I think...
You don't tug your forelock and call it Mr. Jefferson?
I mean, I think, you know, of course we want to be aware of the history, and UVA is now currently building a monument to the enslaved laborers mm-hmm. who built UVA. But I think, you know, we can think more critically, especially at UVA, about who Thomas Jefferson was, and it's not that he was, you know, all these quote-unquote great political things. And yeah, he was a slaveholder. It's, you know, he did those things in tandem. His slaveholding enabled him to accomplish certain things. And I think that's not a narrative that is enforced enough at UVA. And it's very easy for someone to visit the campus, at least as it currently stands, or to attend the university, maybe if they don't take a history class, and not know that he owned slaves. And that, to me, is a major issue. I think...
really? You think that's still the case?
I think hopefully this monument, which I think is going to be fairly substantial, will change that. And, you know, if you read a sign carefully enough, perhaps you will get a sense of this. And there is other great work being done right now. The Now Center for Civil War History is, researching African-American troops from Albemarle mm-hmm. County in the Civil War. And they're working on, I think, some commemoration for those people. So, there's work being done, but I think the kind of uncritical veneration of Thomas Jefferson and the uncritical pride UVA has of being Thomas Jefferson's university and the socks Frank's currently wearing, it's not for me. But, again, I didn't grow up with, reading...
Listeners will, who cannot see Frank's socks. Frank, you want to describe... Your choice of...
I happen, because it's this year conference, to be wearing some Thomas Jefferson socks that were a gift to me. I would say I'm not an uncritical venerator. I'm wearing my socks ironically.
Everyone can tell that Frank's wearing his socks ironically. It's easing out of him.
Ironic sock usage. Okay, good. one of the things that you mentioned earlier I'm curious about, because you mentioned you studied U.S. history in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother's Canadian, and so this has always struck me, that Canadians are much better informed about the United States mm-hmm. than Americans are about Canada. And I say that as an American who, despite having a Canadian mother, knows nothing about Canadian history. And I was curious about what that says about the relationship between the two countries, mm-hmm. that Canadians are both culturally and educationally taught about the United States, whereas, most Americans don't think much about Canada at all, if they ever do.
No, yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I think, the American education system is a bit more provincial, at least in my experience, than the Canadian. But I think Canadians are more aware of what's happening in the United States, partially for not a very enlightened reason, which is that perhaps like Scotland, Canada defines itself against the United States so often. And so that is sort of why we're constantly... I mean, the United States, obviously, being a global superpower, everyone's looking at the United States, but in particular, Canada seems to have this complex. Which I think, has consequences. And so, we say, oh, well, at least our healthcare's better than America, mm-hmm. and that's where we stop, instead of saying, how can our healthcare be improved? So it's, I think, in those ways, that comparison is a way to flatter and console ourselves, as opposed to progress.
Well, and it's interesting you say that, interesting you made reference to Scotland in that, because I think, David and I live in Scotland, of course, and Scotland's relationship to England is very similar, because when you're next to this thing that's 10 times your size, and by definition, washes over you, leaving aside the fact that foreigners confuse you with them as well. Scots don't like to be called English, Canadians don't like to be called American. Yeah. There's a lot of work there. Yeah. It's difficult to ignore, but then the larger entity can ignore it to some extent.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think the Scots are more aware of England than the English are,
and
the Scots in the same way.
Especially of London, right?
Right.
London, Scotland thinks about London, but London doesn't think about Scotland.
Right, I think the analogy is a good one, but that doesn't mean that Americans shouldn't. I mean, I several years ago taught co-taught a course on comparative Canadian and American history with a colleague in Canadian Studies mm-hmm. in Edinburgh. And that was one of the most satisfying teaching experiences I ever had, because I read a ton of Canadian history.
Mm-hmm.
but we also really said, okay, if this is to work, the course really has to be 50-50.
Yeah.
You know, and each session has to be 50-50. And we worked really hard. Unfortunately, that colleague returned to Canada. and so we only ran it once. He was a good friend, Colin Coates.
Yeah.
But it was very, very interesting and very satisfying. And the comparative approach was really, really satisfying, and it raised different questions and answers, and it was a really wonderful experience,
well,
actually. So
yeah,
I think we should do more of that, frankly.
So one of the things that strikes me is at least in the past couple decades, early Americanists have embraced this model of studying early America to include, you know, not only the things that become the 13 colonies, but the, you know, two dozen colonies, you know, stretching from Canada all the way into the Caribbean. And that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so, you know, like Alan Taylor's work and all these other kinds of people who are thinking about sort of a continental-wide colonial era.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the hashtag is vast earlier in
America. Right. Yeah, but, and that basically, those stops, for all intents and purposes, after the revolution happens.
Well, because once you create the nation-state, you're committed to telling the history of that
state,
yeah, but I mean, I just am wondering if there's a place where you could talk about, you know, 19th century North America as a, you know, landmass, and how do you go about doing that?
Well, this is what Colin and I set out to do, because yeah. it began with the conversation, say, hey, you know, Canadian Confederation happened at the same time as Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly there's a sort of reconfiguration
yeah.
politically. This
yeah.
These are new political settlements that are coterminous. What's going on there?
And,
then,
and
of course,
what's going on
there.
In Mexico at the
right.
same time? Yeah, so there's ways in which I think some people are starting to think about this, but it's not, it hasn't filtered in yet into the ways in which, you know, experiments aside, the way in which we actually teach this to students. I mean, I think, you know, the scholarship
mm-hmm.
is starting to get there, but, you know.
Well, again, at least from the U.S. perspective, we're so married to the history of that state, and the state is complicated because you had the constitutional settlement after the Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
You get the Civil War. Well, you have to explain how the Civil War happened, and then the redefinition of the Union after the
mm-hmm.
Civil War, which is your period, David. And we're so wed to that that it's difficult to think, well, what's going on in Manitoba? Even though what's going on in Manitoba might have a lot to tell us when we talk about what's going on in the plains in the 1870s. In fact,
sure.
Of course it does.
Yeah.
And this
yeah.
is the problem. If you're not grounded in, if you don't have that foundation, if your students don't have that foundation, you can't suddenly jump to Manitoba.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
They'll
and
say,
expect them
they'll
to
say, where's
Manitoba?
Yeah, what's
Manitoba?
Manitoba?
Yeah, what's
Manitoba? That's gendered language, you know. You should say Persontoba. Right, exactly. So
yeah.
they don't have the frame of reference, and,
yeah,
and it's
exactly.
hard enough to explain to them what's going on in the United States.
Right.
And, or in, again, in Canadian history, it's,
yeah.
it's
yeah.
so, let alone Mexico.
Well, I mean,
history.
I was struck even when I was teaching in North Dakota, that was the case. When Canada was, like, right there, you know, and you'd go to the mall, and you'd see all these Canadians down there to do their shopping or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, the barrier seemed to really matter,
mm.
At least in terms of, but it was only mattered for people on one side of the border far more than the other.
Well, what is it? There's a figure. It's something like 90% of Canadians live within 200 miles of
the border.
I mean,
yeah.
I think Canada can't afford to ignore the United States.
Yeah.
And as you
yeah.
said, identity is very much premised on defining
against
the United
yeah.
States. So there's a kind of, whereas Americans ignore the rest of the world, including
right.
their near neighbors to a large extent,
mm-hmm.
except when they can't.
Yes.
That's right.
Shira, can we thank you for just
yes.
for having a chat with
yes,
us
yes,
and your
yes.
wonderful contributions.
Thank you.
And we look forward to, well, we'd love to have you on again, but, you know, keep writing and keep tweeting and, you know, and thank you. Anything else you want to add? Anything you want to say?
No, thank you both so much for having me. And, yeah, thanks to everyone at Shira for a great conference.
Yeah.
Yep. Awesome.
Good luck with the new job, and yeah, enjoy the rest of the conference.
Yep, great.
All right. Till next time, Frank.
Cheers,
cheers.
David. Cheers, Shira.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.